Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you through their stories, life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. I'm Rob Greaves, and it's great to have you join me and Baby Boomer Judy Donnelly as Judy shares part of a story with us in this part two of a three-part program on her life. In part one, Judy shared stories of her early years, which had many parallels with stories of kids in Australia in the 1950s, mostly living outdoors and creating our own world around us. We learned that music was very much part of her early life and in fact certainly shaped her later years. In this part of the story, we follow her teen years and how she moved through high school and found herself moving away from the sorority-based teens to the growing hippie movement. We learn by the time that she got to university, it was the early 1970s. But all the social changes going on around her certainly had a big impact. We pick up now with Judy talking about the influx of people from the United States who left trying to avoid the Vietnam draft.
The interesting thing for Canada was that the Canadian universities then, a lot of them were just, there were some older universities like University of Toronto, McGill, but a lot of them were relatively new and building these new, particularly English departments when they needed people to teach American literature and so forth. So a number of my professors were draft dodgers that had maybe been teaching or they just finished their PhDs. And they came up to Canada, got jobs up there.
Right.
There were certainly a number of musicians who came up from Canada who were draft dodgers as well. And they were pretty well supported there. I don't know how the Canadian government felt about it. But and there certainly, I must say, there were also Canadians who volunteered to serve in the war. So, but I don't think I even found that out for 20 years later. So it was an interesting, a very different way of experiencing the war was that we got all these creative intellectuals coming up and making their homes in Canada, you know.
Australia in that period, because we were still always several years behind what was happening, really.
Yeah.
But, you know, that period, 69 through to 72, 68 through to 72, young people in Australia became very socially aware and there was a lot of demonstrating.
Yeah.
Did you have that experience in Canada? Was there a lot of people on the streets demonstrating?
There, I would say not on the streets, certainly at the universities there were. But I could say by the time I got there, that had died down.
Right.
And but we did, I certainly got involved. There was a lot of anti-nuclear demonstrations going on when I was at uni in the early 70s. And I think, you know, in Canada at least, the focus shifted over to that. And there certainly would have been anti-Vietnam War demonstrations going on in the bigger cities in Canada and at the universities, I say, in particular.
You're at university. When you started university, was it with a particular stream in mind? Mm. Did you go there for a particular career, or was it a generalist approach you went to?
It was generalist. I think I just went because my friends were going to university. There's a very good university in Hamilton called McMaster. And so it was just easy to go there. It wasn't far from where my parents' house was at that time. I did an English degree, started an English degree. I'd always enjoyed writing and had done languages as well at high school, so did that as a uni as well. But it was very much having a good time at university. I really wasn't there. It's that sense of a different kind of freedom, I think. So I certainly was not focused on my studies there
like
at all.
Most students at
like
period.
Most yes. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What about
right.
Living? Were you still living with your parents? Were you living on campus?
Was. Yeah, that was very common, unless obviously you're going away to go to uni. Most of us were still living at home. I said because we were fortunate to have this great university in our literally it was in the same neighborhood, you know, where I'd grown up. So yeah, definitely living at home. And this summer, and I kind of thought I might get into doing media or broadcasting or something. I had a radio show when I was at uni, And I'd worked for 2 summers on one of these youth employment schemes, but we were making television shows for the local community station. And I thought, well, look, I've done a bit of that and a bit of this and a bit of writing. So I kind of thought I'd end up doing something like journalism or something like that. And then there was this fateful party where a guy I'd been working with had his guitar at the party and was sort of singing along. He'd been a professional musician, you know, which was like, oh, he actually got paid for it. And I just started singing some harmonies behind him. And, you know, that's, you know, when you've grown up with the Beatles and in choirs, you just sort of do that. Of course. And Crosby, Stills, and Nash and picking out the harmonies. And I got a call a couple of days later. This other friend who'd been at the party said, hey, I've got these friends and they have a gig. And the way the union contracts worked for bands then, if you said you had 6 people in the band and 2 of them were women, you had to show up at your gig with that configuration of musicians.
Yes.
And he knew these people that had that configuration of musicians, and one of the singers, female singers, had just left. And they just needed to basically have another female singer there.
Of course.
And I thought, oh, okay, sure, I'll go. So they came, picked me up. I'd heard of this band.
So you hadn't sung with them or practiced?
No,
or anything?
I'd never sung with a microphone before.
Oh, okay.
And we went to they had like the band house, you know, out in the country outside. And this woman came to the door, the other singer, and she had like long, we all had waist-length hair then, even the guys, as you would remember. And like a long peasant skirt on. And I thought, oh man, she's really super cool. And so we went to the basement, and they'd been a folk band, but they'd transitioned into kind of almost doing a little more, not lounge, that's the wrong word, but they were becoming what was called in kind of bar band, a cover band.
Okay, yes.
Right. And what we would do then, you would work 6 nights in one particular club and do a Saturday matinee. And so that was actually great because it wasn't a lot of money, but it wasn't like having to do a different gig every night or anything. So they were quite desperate, and I think I was pretty crap actually, but went and we did the gig. They had a couple of weeks of gigs. And my parents were away at the time. They had a cottage a few hours away. And so I remember leaving them a note saying, hi, Mom and Dad, gone to blah blah whatever place it was, you know, 4 or 5 hours away with a band, singing with a band for a few weeks. I'll call you in a few days. And I can't imagine what their reaction would have been. So I was 17. No, sorry, wasn't 17, I was 19. And look, I got through the gigs and were being absolutely terrified, but they were all really nice people. And this other woman and I, just Carla's her name, and she's became one of my best friends and someone I ended up singing with for decades after that. So I was about to go back and finish my last year at uni.
Right.
So I went back to school and I just thought, oh, and just didn't want to be there at all.
Yeah.
And I got a phone call from Carla and said, look, we'd really, really like you. We'd really like you to join the band permanently. Because I think by the last gig we did, I was sort of getting the hang of
relaxing
it.
Relaxing and
yeah,
yes,
and she and I had a really good vocal plan band. So I quit university, my poor parents. I'm in my last year of university.
Yep.
And they were, you know, thought I was mad. Plus, here's your daughter's about to go off with a rock band and all the horrors that would one would imagine. Mm-hmm. I promised them I'd finish my degree, and of course I did end up doing that eventually. But anyway, so that's when I started working as a professional singer, musician.
A very exciting period for you.
It was, yeah, and it was the most extraordinary way to see parts of Canada I never would have seen before.
So they did it. They did quite a bit of touring around.
Mostly it was Ontario's huge, it's quite big province,
right.
So there was a lot of work around there. Sometimes it would be local, and we did some gigs in Montreal, and we went to the east coast of Canada a number of times, and that was fantastic. And because you're in one place for 6 nights, you really get to know the place, and, yes. and people are generally very friendly yes. and, you know, want to take you, show you around the sites such as they were. So if we had some fantastic experiences, and also started doing a lot of studio work, Carl and I and the other singer, male singer in the band.
Was this for other people?
Yeah, right. For other people. Supporting so doing sessions, right. you know, doing jingles and backup stuff. So when that band, that lasted about 5 years.
Oh, that was a pretty good
Which effect. Was pretty good.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And in the meantime, I'd done some correspondence courses and kind of been able to wrangle some time when the band was performing more locally than touring, if you want to call it that. So I'd managed to finish my degree, which kept my parents yes. quite happy. And yeah, and kept, but the band split up and I just really wasn't interested in, you know, I'd been doing it for 5 years and mid-20s by then. I thought, yeah, I think I would sort of like to do something else. Because you really get it, even in that time, you get a sense of how tough the music business is. And my way of thinking about things at that time became, well, I'll believe what this person is telling me about, oh, this is going to happen or that's going to happen. I'll believe that when that event is actually over.
And you've tuned in to Listen to Older Voices. Turning Back Time. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Judy Donnelly. And Judy, who was born in Canada, is recalling that part of her life when she was working as a professional singer. The School of Hard Knocks is a school that you really learn from.
You do, yeah. I really grew up a lot out on the road, and you learn how to get along with people really well because you're this little family. You make your family because you're away a lot. And you sort of learn, I think, to be a pretty good judge of character, not only the people you're meeting, but all these people in the music business that promise you this and promise you that.
There's more
and
promises than anything else.
On it goes. But yeah. I think it was, you know, so I wasn't feeling great about the business by that time. So I was kind of glad to get off the road. And I went back and did an extra year at uni.
To live with mum and dad or independent?
No, I kind of, when the band split up, Carla and I actually got a flat. Right. And then she ended up moving to Toronto with her partner she'd met. And that was sort of, I'd moved out of the house by then. So, you know, that was, I never lived with my parents again. So yeah. That was a good experience.
So you do this extra year at university, and then what happens? What do you do with your life?
Well, I was still, fortunately, I was in Hamilton at a time when there was a fair bit of session work going on there. Daniel Lanois and his brother, they'd opened up Grant Avenue Studios. And Carl and I had done some work with them before when they were still in their mum's house outside of Hamilton. And we kind of became the session singers there. They were doing a lot of jingles. And then you just sort of, you know, especially if there's two women that are working together, you end up getting a lot of work in these other studios around. So probably for about the next 4 or 5 years, I had some part-time work. I was working in the marketing department of what would be called a TAFE here. And that sort of subsidized, or the music, you know, was subsidizing, I don't know what was subsidizing what. but we had some great experiences doing, you know, some albums and lots of, let's say, jingles and things. And one of the great memories is doing, there's this really lovely, lovely country star named Dallas Harms in Canada. Lovely man. And he produced records for other country stars. And there was another act called the Mercy Brothers. And they had a studio, which was about an hour and a half outside of Hamilton. And Dallas would go in with Dallas, and there'd be the whole crew of musicians. And you'd start at 9 a.m. And by 11 p.m, you would have recorded a whole album from start to finish, including overdub, vocal, and, you know, overdubs of all kinds for, you know, some person who was on the up and up or just happened to have money to get a record done. And it was really quite an extraordinary experience. We probably did, I don't know, 9 or 10 of those. It was exhausting, but you really, really had to be on your toes.
And you're constantly honing your skills, aren't you? Because
you
of the
are,
pressure
yeah.
of having to deliver constantly like
That's
that.
That's exactly right. And working with some really, really top-notch session musicians. So that was great. And there were two guys that were in a gospel group. And so they would often be the other two singers with Carla and me. So that I look back on that quite fondly. And Dallas was a lovely, lovely guy. And so it wasn't this... I mean, it was high pressure, but it was the atmosphere was always quite pleasant, and surprisingly, the quality of the recordings was quite good. I know you wouldn't always expect that when things are that rushed,
yes,
and you've got the artist there in the studio as well, and of course they would do their lead vocals after, but absolutely everything else was done. So, yeah, so it was nice to keep my fingers in the musical pie, as it were.
So your voice probably exists today on a whole range of pieces of music.
Yeah, it does. You know, most of them have sunk into the depths of obscurity, but they still crop up once in a while. And it was a great experience, like singing on so many different kinds of recordings and jingles and so forth.
Of course,
it was fun.
Spoke a little bit earlier about when you went to the Beatles concert, how you're there for the moment. You don't think about the consequences of that moment 2 years later. In terms of the work you're doing that you're talking about now, did you ever think about, did you ever keep any of this? Did you ever have anything for later on in your life, or is it all gone to the ether now?
No, I've still got, Carla and I did some cassettes of sort of all the jingles and things we've done that we were trying to market ourselves with. And I came across one when I was moving over here, actually, and I think I've got it somewhere. I think my son might have digitized it for me somewhere. And they're quite interesting to listen to. Quite proud of them, really. You know,
good.
Yeah.
So you should be.
Yeah.
The music thing for you, it sounds like when we talk about professional music, it's been going for at least 10 years over all the band and then all the session work.
Yeah.
Did it dry up, or did you make a conscious decision to stop?
I think it was a combination of both, Rob. I'd made a conscious decision certainly not to do a band live thing anymore when this first band split up. And then, as I was saying, more into session work. And, of course, that paid really, really well.
Oh, yes.
Especially if you got a jingle that had residuals.
Because music
and so
in
forth.
Canada's, when I say unionised, there's no such thing as unionised music, but the people in the industry are unionised, so you've got very set things, isn't it? You can't be ripped off easily.
No, and when you got into doing the really what I call high-end jingles in Toronto, and I did those for a few years, and they were, you know, the pressure of doing them was 20 times what the other work was. Then you're getting residuals, and it's through, it's all monitored through ACTRA, which is like, I don't know what the equivalent, like APRA, where you get paid this much for the original session. And then if the jingle goes into another cycle, then you get the residuals from it. So, and I really got to work with some incredible people doing that. That was great. But yeah, it just sort of petered out, and I was wanting to just sort of do something else with my life by that time.
That time, what time are we talking? Rough.
I'm in my early 30s then, yeah.
So early 80s then.
Yeah, early 80s. And I did join another band that was in a city that was about an hour and a half away from where I lived, so it wasn't convenient. And it was a bunch of guys that I'd known from the band era. You know, we had the same manager.
Yes.
Yeah, lovely, lovely guys. And that was just logistically crazy. And during that time, I decided actually to go back to school and get my master's degree. And it was a really funny band because we were all in our early 30s. So we'd be playing at a bar and then we'd run to the dressing room. And I remember at one point it was then called a library and information science degree because I'd always loved doing research.
Right.
And I thought, oh, that's what librarians get to do. So, and I'd had two friends that had gone through the course and I thought that would be pretty cool to do that. But going back to the dressing room, working with these guys, and one of them was in law school, so he's sitting there looking at his law books. The drummer was doing his PhD in hydrogeology, so he's going through all his research notes. And we had a guitar player from Boston who he was doing his master's in mathematics. And so we were like the most boring band you've ever seen in your life.
So it's almost like a study group in between buckets.
Exactly, yeah. And then the singer, of course, the other singers, he's just out drinking and having a good time. And the rest of us are all, you know, it was like the antithesis of yes. the rock, the wild rock bands. It was pretty, pretty funny. But then that started me into this academic life, right. which was completely different, but equally rich and rewarding and full of wonderful people. Again, I'm still really friends.
So what was your first job in that genre?
The first job I got was a summer job, was setting up a library for the visiting, we're called Victorian Order of Nurses. So it's like the visiting nurses service here.
Right.
So they go around to people's houses and do the in-home care. And that was interesting. I'd always kind of been interested in nursing and science, so that was a really mm-hmm. cool job. But then I got, as I was finishing my degree, I'd done a few courses with this particular professor who's since become a really good colleague, friend, and she hired me to do this on this research project that was looking at, I sort of segued into the rare book world. So it was looking at really early Canadian imprints.
Oh.
And I did that with her, and she'd gotten a grant when one could still get grants for those kinds of things, to sort of fill in these big gaps in print history of Canada.
So it's a knowledge-based thing rather than an industry focused.
Yeah, absolutely. It was pure research, yes. and it was recognizing that, you know, we don't know enough about these early publications, and that started, that led from one contract to another within this research community at different universities. I mean, it was mostly based in around Toronto or Hamilton where I lived, and I did actually work in some of these libraries, these rare book libraries, and again met this lovely community of other researchers, very diverse people, and the academic world's fascinating. And so that was sort of my home, as it were, and it's still my home, because I worked in large academic libraries that had archives sections to them as well, and that's ended up being the work that I do here. So, and I think the academic world was kind of fascinated with the fact that I'd been a singer. We're like, what the heck is that? That mm-hmm. rock singing stuff.
Yeah,
it sort of worked.
There's not a usual connection between those two.
Exactly.
Worlds.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So that was just wonderful.
Let's finish off with the track titled "Thank You for Being My Friend," which features the wonderful voice of Judy Donnelly.
hope you come back next week for the final part of Judy's story, when we learn of the relationship that triggered her to migrating to Australia when she was in her 50s, and the wonderful life she's carved out living with her partner Sam in Belgrave, located in Melbourne's Dandenong Ranges. That's next week, the final part of the story of Judy Donnelly on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Turak Times.